This is Kate Swanell for the Medical Journal of Australia. Today I'm talking with Professor Paul Komisaroff, who is Executive Director of Global Reconciliation and is also Director of the Monash Centre for Ethics in Medicine and Society. Thank you for your time, Professor.
You're welcome.
Now, you've written a piece for our 18th of May issue on voluntary euthanasia. This is a debate that seems to go round and round and round for years now. Why is that, and why is it so difficult for us to make forward progress?
The question of euthanasia is a very emotional one. It's been a very contentious question in public debate for many decades now. Part of the problem is that the sides are very polarised. Mm. On the one hand, there are people who argue that it's the right of any individual not only to choose when and how they die, but to be killed if they choose to end their life. Yes. at any particular time. There are aspects of this argument that many of us would agree with. In particular, most of us would agree that if an individual didn't want to be treated for a particular condition or was suffering from a terminal condition and was in pain, they should receive adequate medical care for that. Not everyone, however, agrees that any individual has the right to be killed at any particular time, or that it's appropriate for the society to set up mechanisms whereby people who choose to be put to death can undergo that kind of process.
It does kind of have echoes of the Nazi era, doesn't it? It brings back bad memories.
It does, and many people have drawn that analogy. There are a number of places in the world where there are legal mechanisms for assisting with the death of people who choose to die. Mm. And they appear to work pretty well. So in the United States, a number of states, Oregon was the leader. In Europe, a number of countries, the Netherlands, Switzerland and Belgium and so on, have legislation that in one form or another enable someone, mostly in conditions of terminal illness, yes, to be able to be put to death. In some cases, it's the limitations or restrictions are more rigorous than others. Mm. On the other side of the debate are people who object not either to the principle or to the process and to the potential risks, mm, such as the ones to which you've drawn attention. They include people with a religious disposition, notably the Catholic Church, and also the medical profession, which has always expressed a profound sense of discomfort about incorporating into their usual practices the possibility that they may take active steps to kill their patients. Many doctors say this is not our job, we're not executioners, we're here to preserve life. Having said that, there's a substantial minority within the medical profession who believe that it's a matter of freedom or autonomy, mm-hmm, for individuals to be able to choose how and when they die, and that it's part of the doctor's job to be able to assist or support patients in carrying out their wishes. So these are strong and valid arguments. It's, you know, both sides have a high degree of cogency. The trouble is, though, that over many decades we've not been able to make any progress whatsoever. Yeah. And the debate goes round and round. There have been a number of surveys of the general public, and they have tended to show that there's a high degree of support for the principle that people should be able to choose when and how they die. And surveys of doctors have shown that many doctors state or recognise that there are circumstances in which medications that they may give have hastened the, yes, deaths of their patients. So it's a complex area. There are differing opinions, And but there's up until now been no clear way forward.
Now, you've suggested that what you called a sort of minimalist legislative solution. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts on that.
One of the claims of doctors has been that there's no need for legislation because the law already enables us to do what we need to do.
Mm.
Not everyone agrees with that, and indeed there's never been a case in Australia that's tested what's essentially the situation in common law, which was introduced by a legal judgment in the United Kingdom in 1957, which essentially states that what's referred to in the ethical language as the principle of double effect.
Right.
That is that one can undertake an act for one particular purpose, knowing that it may carry with it an unintended consequence.
Yes.
that may have a negative aspect to it. In this case, the judgment by Lord Denning in the United Kingdom stated that it was appropriate from a legal point of view for a doctor to administer a drug or a medical treatment in order to alleviate suffering.
Mm.
In a patient, for example, who was suffering from a terminal illness, knowing that there was the possibility that this treatment may lead to death. But it wasn't the primary purpose, it wasn't the intention of the doctor in administering this medication.
Yes.
In order actively to cause death. It's an important distinction. Not everyone is comfortable with it. I think it really is actually an important distinction. I can't myself conceive of a situation where it would be my primary purpose or intent to kill someone. Mm. On the other hand, it often arises that I'm in a situation where I provide medications that will help alleviate suffering.
Yes.
And I know that it may well be that the administration of these medications could have the unintended but important effect of hastening that person's death. So I really do believe that there's a genuine principle of double effect.
Mm.
So essentially, the principle of double effect has been recognised since the 1950s as a principle of common law in this setting. It's never been introduced through statutory regulation, and there's uncertainty about its status in Australia.
Right.
As I said, there's never been an explicit test in Australia, although there have been a number of cases overseas. What we're proposing is that as a first step towards breaking the deadlock in the ongoing, relatively fruitless debate about
yes.
euthanasia, the particular case of a patient with terminal illness who is experiencing intractable suffering should be subject to this legal principle, which now becomes explicitly stated in legislation and commonly adopted throughout all the jurisdictions in Australia. So this would mean that each of the states, because this is state legislation mm-hmm. that we're talking about, would alter their criminal legislation in order to recognise explicitly the principle of double effect in the setting of terminal illness and intractable suffering.
And that's a relatively simple legislative process once it's agreed upon, isn't it?
It would be a simple, straightforward process. It would be a minor extension of the law as it already exists.
Yeah.
And indeed, some states, notably South Australia, Queensland and Western Australia, have some legislation that resembles that, referring specifically to the condition of palliative care.
Right.
So in those cases, it would actually be a very small step forward. But the advantage would be that, first of all, there would be uniformity around Australia for
mm-hmm.
the first time. Secondly, there would be clarity in relation to the protections that a doctor may have when carrying out what many of us think is already best practice.
Yeah.
And thirdly, it would take out of the equation, out of the public debate, the most important part of the euthanasia question, which is how to manage patients in the terminal phases of their illness who are suffering from severe pain or distress of one sort or another.
What about the more difficult cases, say somebody with a chronic illness that just doesn't want to go on? It's not necessarily a terminal illness, but they want to have the choice to end their lives. Would your suggestion cover that, or is that a more extreme case that needs its own?
No, so it wouldn't cover that, and it would leave that for the focus of the debate from now on.
Right.
And that's precisely our intention. I think the question in relation to chronic illness or patients who simply choose to die for their own purposes or for their own reasons represent very different kinds of questions.
Yeah.
And I think part of the problem with the euthanasia debate is that we've run together a whole lot of different issues that really need to be considered separately.
Right.
So I think the question of treating people in the terminal phases of their illness who are suffering from severe pain is one issue on which there's a high degree of consensus. The question of someone with a chronic illness, such as multiple sclerosis or motor neurone disease, who looks ahead in despair to the future that they may have and seeks assistance in dying, that's a very different question. There are very different arguments, very different ethical principles that should apply. So what we really would like to see is to move away from the debate where I think most of us already agree and where there are legal devices already available to us, and to start talking about the more complex and difficult questions. I should say no one so far in the Australian debates has explicitly tackled the question of people with chronic disease.
Mm.
Almost all the debate has focused on terminal illness. So
yes,
it really would resolve a large part of the contention and enable us to move forward to the more difficult and complex areas.
It would seem to be a debate that's gaining some urgency given the ageing population and, you know, the rise of some chronic diseases and things like that, but taking little steps like this is a good way forward. Yeah.
So that's an important point, and the ageing population, the significance of the increasing expense associated with caring for elderly people is one of the aspects of this debate that unsettles a number of us, including myself. It's become part of the discussion that elderly people are taking up a large part of our healthcare budget. I don't accept that that's the case, and I certainly don't accept that they're not entitled to whatever medical care they require. But in the current economic climate, I'm concerned that there could be pressure on elderly people to seek to end their lives or to withdraw medical care on the basis that they feel that they've become a burden either to their families or to society more broadly. So I think, you know, that's a serious issue that we need to think through very carefully.
Mm.
And here too, we need a fully informed public debate that is not corrupted by extraneous issues that can really be addressed in their own right separately.
Have you had a chance to float the suggestion with politicians, policymakers?
Yes. In fact, in developing the idea, we've talked very widely with a number of organisations, including the professional associations, and that includes the Australian Medical Association, medical colleges, and so on. Also representatives within the Catholic Church who historically have been the main opponents of euthanasia law change, and political parties. Our impression at this stage is that there are really very few objections to the proposal that we're putting forward.
Mm.
From the point of view of medical professionals who have been very disquieted by the idea that they would become legalised executioners, this is really a way forward, partly because it puts into explicit legislation what many of us believe is already the law.
Yeah.
Interestingly, the Members of the Catholic Church to whom I've spoken have also been supportive. And the reason for that is that the principle of double effect originally was actually a Catholic doctrine from medieval times. So this is part of the tradition of Catholic ethical thinking.
Right.
So it's consistent with the perspective that they would often take.
Okay.
So I think that would represent quite an important step forward, because it's recognising the nature of the concerns and the methods of thinking of one of the main sources of opposition to change in this area. And in relation to the politicians or other organisations, it's a divided area. There's a committed group of people who argue on the basis of patient freedom of autonomy that there should be explicit legislation to support euthanasia. I personally think that would be very divisive in the community, and we're really not ready for it, mm-hmm. if we ever will be.
Right. Tell us a little about Global Reconciliation and the work the group's doing.
Global Reconciliation is an international NGO based in Australia. It's an Australian initiative that seeks to promote communication and dialogue across difference, across cultural, racial, religious, political and other kinds of difference. And we work in 30 or 40 different countries at the present time. At the level of communities, not to provide funds or services, but really to facilitate people coming together to seize control in order to improve their own conditions of life. And the way we work specifically is through ordinary practices, so using healthcare, for example, as a platform or a device on which people can come together and overcome their differences.
Right.
So the idea of this is intuitively very obvious, in the sense that there's a common ethos of caring that everyone involved in healthcare can share. But in reality, it's not so straightforward, because you can introduce healthcare services in such a way that they actually increase the hierarchical divisions in the society,
yeah.
that they work in favour of social control rather than democracy. So in order to devise a healthcare program that actually brings people together, particularly in post-conflict settings,
yes.
Requires quite a lot of careful planning. So, for example, one of the areas in which we're working, amongst many, is Sri Lanka, a country that has suffered a tragic civil conflict that went on for nearly 30 years and ended in 2009. Naturally, there are deep cultural divisions in this country. In order to bring the people together from the different ethnicities, different ethnic groups, it's important to devise social programs in which they would share common concerns and common goals.
Right.
So healthcare is a way of doing this. And in particular, recognition of the damage that the conflict has done to the younger generation,
yes.
on all sides, is something that everyone can agree with.
Yes.
The same applies in the Middle East, where we've been active. If one talks about how to resolve the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis, and for example discusses the question of who should own Jerusalem, it's very rare for there to be any new argument or suggestion that hasn't been aired for 3,000 years.
Exactly.
On the other hand, if we talk to parents on both sides, Palestinians and Israeli Jewish parents, about the psychological trauma associated with the conflict, they're in immediate agreement, and they have a common bond. So if we develop a program around healthcare of that sort, we can find ways in which people can get together, can become to respect each other, get to know each other, recognise that in fact they have the same goals. So this is our concept of reconciliation as a community-based process.
And do you go to the level of helping them raise funds for hospital stay, or is it, are you basically just facilitating negotiations between other groups?
Yeah, we would do both.
Right.
So we only go into a community when we're invited to do so.
Mm.
And we say that our, as I said before, that our purpose is a facilitatory one. But we will assist in trying to find support for a particular program. One of the programs for which we are actively seeking to find support at the moment aims to bring together the various parties around the world, not just in Israel and Palestine, but in Australia and elsewhere, in order to provide health care to the children of the area.
Yes.
And specifically, we're starting with one of the areas of greatest need, which is the children of Gaza,
yes.
Who are innocent victims, and I think all sides are culpable in this respect, that these are children who have no part in the conflict, who have suffered terribly as a result of actions from both sides. And I think what we've proposed is that it's time for the international community to step in a non-political, non-aligned way, and to demonstrate that it's possible for people to work together in order to address what's one of the most terrible, tragic and pressing problems in the world today.
Are there any Australian situations in which global reconciliation would get involved?
Yes, we do lots of things in Australia.
Terrific.
And obviously we work with Indigenous groups and Indigenous healthcare and is an important area. I should say that we work not... I've mentioned healthcare as an example, but we work in relation to many other kinds of practices, in particular sport, which is another important way of bringing people together, which can also be corrupted a bit like healthcare can. So sport can be literally a level playing field where people from all backgrounds come together and they work in a harmonious and friendly way. But it can also be something where the ethos of winning at all costs or high payments and so on take over and undermine that real, genuine, ethical purpose of sport. We also work in the setting of the arts, which is another example, in environmental care, in business. In Australia, one of the key areas that we're focused on is the division amongst diaspora groups, amongst immigrant groups from countries from around the world, particularly where the people coming here are fleeing conflict or division in their own societies. I've mentioned the Sri Lankan community, which is a very big and important community in Australia that's contributed in an extraordinary way to Australian culture.
Yeah.
And the Sri Lankan immigration to Australia goes back to the 1850s, so it's really an important part of our heritage. But the community has been unfortunately very divided, pretty much along the same lines as the civil conflict in Sri Lanka itself. So it's important for people within Australia to find ways to assist these communities to heal themselves. And we've worked with friends and colleagues on both sides of the Sri Lankan community to try to bring them together, to foster dialogues, and to look for ways in which we can rebuild those community links. Other communities include communities from the Horn of Africa, where in particular the Sudanese, the South Sudanese community, the Somali community, and so on, which again have tended to reflect divisions and conflicts within their own society, where we're trying to provide whatever resources we can to assist these communities in healing themselves. So the organisation's conceived as a network rather than as a formal membership association. So we, in fact, bring in many hundreds of people around the world. The core group in Melbourne is relatively modest. Funding is always a major problem because we don't advertise, certainly we don't advertise showing the faces of young children we don't use marketing techniques that are sometimes that some organisations do that are sometimes questionable. But also the nature of the work that we do is perhaps less tangible or less spectacular than providing material services or goods that can be depicted in marketing programs.
But you're a long-term solution rather than a short-term fix,
A long-term solution that aims primarily to work with communities to enable them to articulate their needs and then to build the capacity within those communities so that whatever changes occur can be sustainable.
Fantastic. Thank you for your time today.
It's a pleasure, Kate. Thank you for talking with me.
Terrific. Done. Perfect.
Is that okay?
Yeah, it's great.
Was the phone a problem?
No, not at all. Done. Magic.
So we've got this thing. We're trying to raise some seeding funding for this Gaza project.
Yes.
And we've got, it's a big job. We think we need $1 million to put